right now, on day one of President Biden's administration, came out with an executive order saying, federal government, you need to reinstate this interagency working group on the social cost of greenhouse gases. This is a group of top economists and scientists across the federal government. I think there are at least 11 different agencies that are involved in this, to update the U.S. government's social cost of carbon and pay attention to these National Academy of Sciences recommendations for improving the science. So this interagency working group I know has been meeting, and they've been discussing the updates to the science. I don't know exactly at what points they will come out with their findings, but hopefully it will. When they do, it will take into account the science and the platform that we have put forward here in this study.
Are you aware of any other governments who have already set such a high price for carbon, the social cost of carbon?
The German government, the German equivalent of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, actually uses a higher social cost of carbon in its analysis. The Canadian government uses social cost of carbon, and I expect we'll be updating its value in the coming years as well. So I think that there will be a lot of work around the world on the social cost of carbon ends up taking note of and piggybacking a bit on the process that the United States runs for estimating the social cost of carbon, simply because it is so labor-intensive and there's so much that goes into actually updating these numbers that when somebody puts that kind of an effort behind it, the amount of scrutiny it goes through in terms of public comments and scientific review and so on, that often is something that that other governments look to advise them in their own numbers.
What is Resources for the Future?
Resources for the Future is a nonpartisan economics think tank that is sort of reason for being is to inform natural resource and environmental decisions using nonpartisan fact-based analysis.
We've got an audience of climate-aware, educated listeners. Do you have a final message or something you would like to tell them about this issue?
Our study indicates that the federal government in the United States, anyway, has been effectively undercounting the damages from climate change in its own analysis and also undervaluing the benefits of the actions that it's been taking to address climate change.
From Resources for the Future, we've been speaking with Dr. Kevin Rennert. He is the lead author of the new paper, Comprehensive Evidence Implies a Higher Social Cost of CO2. You can read more about this in some blog postings at rff.org. That is all the time we have, packed to the minute. Tune in next week for more breaking climate news. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programmings of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website, kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing, unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Governance and Policy Committee meets quarterly on the third Tuesday of March, June, September, and December at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify that a meeting is being held.
Tune in to KBOO on Wednesday, October 5th for Dead Moon Night,
a four-hour extravaganza
celebrating the 2017 event when 1,100 rockers showed up outside Portland City Hall
to commemorate the legendary band Dead Moon in an official city proclamation of October 5th as Dead Moon Night.
Again, that's Dead Moon Night, Wednesday, October 5th, from 8 p.m. till midnight.
Here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
This is Rising Up with Sonali, a weekly news and analysis program focused on economic, racial, gender, justice, and more. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar, and you can find us online at risingupwithsonali.com. This week, we'll examine the first year of Joe Biden's presidency with Brooke Adams, Movement Politics Director at People's Action. Adams will also share her organization's strategy for moving the needle on progressive change over the next year. Then, as the COVID-19 pandemic has been an environmental disaster in addition to a humanitarian one, we'll speak with Melissa Valiant of Oceana about a new poll showing broad support for regulating and reducing single-use plastic. Finally, Anna Gifty Opoku Agyeman joins me to discuss the new book she's edited called The Black Agenda: Bold Solutions for a Broken System. That's coming up in just a moment. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. 1 year into Joe Biden's presidency, Democrats, who have a razor-thin control of the Senate and House, haven't had as much success in passing visionary progressive legislation as many voters thought, with the ambitious Build Back Better bill stalled and two corporate Democrats, Kirsten Sinema and Joe Manchin, stymieing filibuster reform. We turn today to Brooke Adams, Director of Movement Politics at People's Action, to understand the reasoning behind the status quo and how we might change it. Welcome to the program, Brooke.
Thank you so much, Sonali. It's a pleasure to be here.
So first, how do you assess Biden's presidency, understanding that he is limited by what Congress can do? I mean, most Americans, when polled, might say, you know, that he has utterly failed because, of course, they're only seeing the achievements. But you are, you know, among those folks who monitors how the sausage is made, if you will. Understanding all of that, how do you assess President Biden's leadership this past year?
Thank you for the question. So I would say, first off, there have been big victories since Biden has taken office. But at the same time, he has not done everything he can as our president to advance a progressive agenda that will benefit working people all across this country. So let me maybe start with the good, because, you know, I think sometimes we get so muddled in all of the challenges that we're facing at the federal level that we lose sight of some of the victories that were won in recent months, that in many ways have been some of the most landmark pieces of legislation for working people in recent history. So the American Rescue Plan, right? This is something that was all over the news recently, but the debate has shifted recently to Build Back Better. The American Rescue Plan was perhaps the most significant piece of legislation to benefit working people in this country in decades. And it may lead to the lowest child poverty rate on record, right? It included a big boost to many direct payments to people. And though some of those payments could have been bigger, the impacts of that are still extremely significant. It cut child poverty in half. It included housing assistance for millions of Americans. It really boosted employment and included funding for schools, vaccines, relief for small businesses, et cetera. A few of the other things that have happened since Biden took office. The number of Americans with health coverage in this country is at the highest level ever. And President Biden took good steps on key issues such as ending surprise billing that have impacted millions of Americans' experience with the healthcare system here. On climate, again, much more that needs to be done, but we've rejoined the Paris Agreement, which is an exciting victory for us that moves us in the direction this country needs to go in. So you mentioned, Sonali, right, that President Biden only has a certain amount of power given the fact that Democrats only hold a razor slim margin in Congress, or sorry, in the Senate. But I do want to lift up that there are a number of executive actions that he could have taken and could still take that he has not done, right? He could eliminate student debt for 42 million borrowers in this country with the stroke of a pen. He could increase federal action on climate and actually bring us to hitting the Paris goals through executive action. And he could seize drug patents developed with public money to make sure people can actually afford life-saving medications during a pandemic. So in summary, I would say, yes, there have been big victories since President Biden has taken office, but the Build Back Better agenda is tangled up in the Senate right now. And the best thing that President Biden could do is use the power that he has to actually move some of these executive actions to protect everyday people. And I do wanna lift up too that, you know, Build Back Better is stalled in the Senate because of the two corporate Democrats that you mentioned, but also because corporations have funneled millions and millions of dollars into lobbying to block this agenda. And so oftentimes, right, we spend a lot of time focusing in on evaluating senators and the president. But in reality, what's behind the curtain is a massive corporate attack on a progressive agenda that actually is, in fact, quite popular.
And I want to talk about that briefly. But I just also want to add, you know, on an individual level, I'd like to throw out, is there a mandate between now and November, given this thin political power that Biden has and the Democrats have, is there a mandate to take bold visionary changes, or should they play it safe?
This is the question that we see debated over and over again, every single cycle in the national news.
And by saying, should they play it safe, I was playing devil's advocate and channeling the Washington Post op-ed pages, for example.
Right, yes, exactly. And who's writing those op-eds, right? It's oftentimes groups like the Chamber of Commerce that are backed by big businesses who have a direct stake in blocking the passage of policies that are actually quite popular with the American people. So to answer your question in short, yes, there is a mandate for Democrats to campaign in a way that actually appeals to the changes that people all across this country desperately need. And let's be honest, people are exhausted. It has been a tough couple of years with the pandemic and with just the fluctuation in our political and economic realities right now. And what people need is not to be told that once again, we're going to play it safe and actually refrain from making any meaningful change in this country. People need a vision, because in moments when we are tired, right, when this country has gone through what in many ways is a collective trauma over the past couple of years, the only thing that will really move us out of that and inspire people to really see that politics can and does matter in their lives is bold campaigning. And I do want to lift up, you know, oftentimes the reason that politicians are told to play it safe is, again, because corporations and the wealthy have a direct stake in them campaigning on a middle of the road agenda. But when you actually break down the facts about what's popular in this country, many of the elements of Build Back Better and many of the elements of what progressive organizations all across this country are fighting for are indeed quite popular with the American electorate. More than two-thirds of people support raising taxes on corporations and the wealthy. More than 80% of adults think that prescription drugs are unreasonably expensive. Most people in this country support building enough new nonprofit and publicly owned homes to ensure everyone in the US has a place to live. Two-thirds of adults say that the federal government is doing too little on climate change, right? The statistics go on and on and on. In reality, people are actually hungry for the sort of visionary change that oftentimes, again, groups like the Chamber of Commerce are telling Democrats to avoid and move closer to the center because they're afraid of losing their profits.
So let's talk about the way in which People's Action has managed to kind of break through the logjam at the granular level, at the grassroots level. Unfortunately, people get bombarded by the centrist propaganda in their newspapers and their television screens. But your organization has been using this method that you call deep canvassing to not just find out where people are, but to actually push the needle on political desires and on trying to, you know, understand where people are and push them to have that progressive change that they want. Tell me about deep canvassing.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Sonali. People's Action's Deep Canvas program is built to cut through the noise of the propaganda that people are hearing on Fox News, right, blasted on their TVs every single day. Because again, the reality is the majority of Americans need better healthcare, agree that climate change is a major threat that we are facing in this country, right? Want better, safe, livable homes. And the reason that they aren't with us or perhaps haven't made up their minds in elections is not because they don't want these improvements in their lives. It's because they are so blasted with fear-driven messaging, oftentimes racist fear-driven messaging from the right, that creates mass confusion, mass disinformation, and ultimately pushes people to vote against their own interests. And so with our Deep Canvas program, what we are aiming to do is build deep, meaningful connections with voters on the doors and on the phones, right, in every single conversation we have that can cut through some of that noise and actually build a relationship that's rooted in empathy, in listening, that can bring people in to seeing this big picture vision of how all of us can thrive and benefit once we have a government and an economy that cares for all of us. So instead of giving our canvassers poll tested, DC, you know, created messaging that they just go regurgitate on the doors, we actually train people in softer skills, like how to listen, how to ask questions, how to engage with curiosity, and ultimately how to build a one-to-one relationship with people on the doors, so that voters are able to see that what differentiates us is actually not so great, and what brings us together under wanting and needing this shared agenda is much stronger and can last for the long haul. Because ultimately we know, end of the day, that no matter what we do, there are going to be fear-driven messages on immigration, right? Telling voters that they have to pick either the climate or their jobs and we can't have both. And the only way we get in front of that is by actually building lasting relationships with people. So when all of that fear-driven messaging comes, people remember the hope and the connection that they had with the folks who talked to them on the doors and on the phones. And that compels us all to actually build together the government and the economy that we need.
Brooke, you co-wrote an op-ed in USA Today with Representatives Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar last fall, where you point out that there is support among Americans for, say, Medicare for all. We've just had a conversation today with the California Nurses Association expert about CalCare, which is a single-payer bill in California. But of course, at the federal level, we have a bill as well. And we're always, you know, there's the naysayers against single-payer gets so much space in the op-ed pages. But tell me what you and Tlaib and Omar find and share in your op-ed about healthcare single payer for all.
I mean, the findings are simple. It's that the majority of Americans actually want and need Medicare for all. And I will say first, I actually think it is extremely popular. And when people do not support it, it is oftentimes just because of the fear-driven messaging, again, around the buzzword, and not because of what the policy would mean in people's lives, right? We have been experiencing a global pandemic for over 2 years now. I think most Americans understand at this point that healthcare is something that needs to be a human right, that all of us have fair access to in order for people to have the basic necessities they need to survive here in this country. And Americans identify time and time again, healthcare is a top priority in elections, right? And so when we see middle of the road corporate Democrats avoiding Medicare for all and avoiding taking strong stances, I guarantee you the vast majority of them are receiving money from private insurers and potentially even hospitals, right, within their localities. And this is what drives them to actually avoid campaigning and being champions on issues like Medicare for all, right?
What's really interesting, Brooke, is that you don't hear the critics of Medicare for all complaining about the fact that the government has picked up the cost of COVID-19 testing, vaccines, you know, distribution, the cost of even treatment, most COVID-19 treatment. If you are stricken with the virus and you're uninsured, the government will generally pay for most of your treatment. There's this COVID-19 exception that has gone under the radar over the past 2 years, where we have assumed it is a given for the government to use public funds to pay for our care, but only if you catch the virus. If you have cancer and are uninsured, you're out of luck. And it's really interesting that we haven't heard the private insurers, or you haven't heard, you know, the Heritage Foundation or these other corporate profiteers who want to preserve the private health insurance system complain about this, because it would be really horrifying to hear them complain about people's care being covered. There is a COVID-19 exception.
Yeah, it is a very interesting fact, Sonali. And I think in part speaks to some of the work that was done through the American Rescue Plan to normalize the expectation that COVID actually be something that the government is putting federal money into. At the same time, I would just say that Americans are horrified enough by this pandemic that if corporations, if private insurers started coming after this policy, it would just be so revealing of their interests as opposed to the interests of the health and well-being of the American people that I don't think they could come back from it.
But it's interesting also that there hasn't been enough connection made between, well, if the government's going to cover COVID-19 care, why aren't we covering other care? You know, why aren't we covering cancer care, diabetes care, et cetera, et cetera? Then let's talk about what it's going to take to push things forward. With just going back to the issue of deep canvassing. In fact, I had spoken to someone else at People's Action before the November 2020 election about how deep canvassing was shown to, you know, increase turnout for Biden. Your organization actually did a lot of canvassing work around the country and helped move the needle, you know, even in the tiniest way to ensure that Trump wouldn't have a second term. But here we are stymied once more with these, you know, with the midterm elections coming up in 2022. How can deep canvassing ensure that Biden not only retains his Democratic majority, but that the House and Senate control is large enough that we can have Build Back Better? The House could go to Republicans. The Senate could go to Republicans.
Yeah, it's a great question. And look, I think looking ahead towards 2022, there's a lot to be worried about. And I do think that our Deep Canvas program is one of the areas in which, at least for me, there is a lot of hope about what is possible in this country too. So the major things I would say, our Deep Canvas is actually meant to appeal to people who are conflicted. And I do think the progressive movement has made huge strides over the past decade to elect champions to federal office. But when you look at where those victories have happened, the vast majority of them have been in safely blue areas. And so there's a lot of work that we need to do to actually build our base, right, and preach beyond the choir and reach conflicted voters, especially working class conflicted voters who have a direct stake in the sort of policies that we are campaigning on, but perhaps aren't already voting with us or have not made up their mind yet. And our Deep Canvas program in 2022 is actually focused on building infrastructure in Republican-held turf that, frankly, the Democratic Party has not been building the infrastructure it needs to win in for decades. Because these are the areas where there's vast communities of people who, again, really need the things that we're campaigning on, but are conflicted. And come November, their votes are going to be critical for determining the makeup of the House and the Senate. And so, you know, People's Action deep canvasses everywhere. But in 2022, we are really focused in on building infrastructure in some of these Republican-held areas, particularly in rural areas and in small towns and cities, where we know that people, you know, care about healthcare, care about housing, are directly impacted by these issues, and ultimately could build relationships with our canvassers that would bring them into being a part of fighting for the agenda that we need to win post 2022.
Brooke, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Give out a website for People's Action and where people can find out about the Deep Canvassing Project.
Yes, you can go to peoplesaction.org.
That's peoplesaction.org. Brooke, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Brooke Adams, Director of Movement Politics at People's Action. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RUWithSonali. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. The COVID-19 pandemic was, by all accounts, disastrous for humanity, with nearly a million people in the United States alone having lost their lives. But it has also been an environmental disaster, with an explosion of plastic-based protective products being consumed and discarded, and many localities rolling back pre-pandemic regulations that reduced or banned single-use plastic. The good news is that a new poll finds broad public support for addressing the ongoing plastic pollution crisis that threatens our oceans, our biodiversity, and us. My guest is Melissa Valiant. She is the Senior Communications Manager at the Group Oceana. Welcome to the program, Melissa.
Hi there. Thank you so much for having me on.
So first, let's talk about what impact the pandemic has had on our plastics crisis. I remember I live in a city that had banned plastic bags, and there was broad support for it. And of course, as soon as the pandemic hit, you went into grocery stores and you had the plastic bags were back because people were terrified that reusable bags could spread the virus. And it seems as though there's been a setback for the movement against plastic pollution. Is that true?
So the good news is we're actually still seeing a lot of movement on the local, state, and even federal level with single-use plastic regulation. So we are seeing plastic bag bans. We're seeing plastic foam bans. So, you know, those plastic peanuts and plastic little airbags that come into your online orders. We're still seeing that rise in the past 2 years. And so I'm excited about that. I think the thing you got to keep in mind with the pandemic is that this was an unprecedented event. And number one priority was people's safety. And so we needed to follow the advice of public health experts who were recommending things like masks. So instead of focusing on the PPE, which was absolutely necessary for our current situation, we need to go after the stuff that really doesn't need to be there. So like our plastic straws, single-use plastic water bottles, plastic takeout containers, like these are the things that aren't necessary that we have innovative replacements for, like reusable and refillable products.
So let's talk about the fact that your organization commissioned this survey that took the pulse of the public and of course then honed in on how things differed by whether they were Republican or Democrat, etc. What was the poll aiming to determine in terms of support for ending single-use plastic?
So yes, we released some new plastic polling results last week, and so these were through Ipsos. They polled Americans and also registered voters, and we found that 8 in 10 American voters were supportive of single-use plastic regulations on the local, state, and even the federal level, which is really exciting. It was 81% of American voters that were supportive of these kind of bans of things like plastic bags, things like takeout containers that I mentioned, plastic beverage bottles. Like there's overwhelming, and not just overwhelming support among American voters, but overwhelming bipartisan support among American voters. So it's really exciting because I think that the policy action is what we need in order to actually tackle this. Unfortunately, it's not going to come down to just individual actions.
So what is that policy? Tell me about the kinds of policies that can be taken both at the local level, at the state level as well, and then, of course, thirdly, at the federal level to address single-use plastic. You know, you have the plastic industry and industries that rely on cheaply available single-use plastics that want self-regulation. They want to have voluntary measures to be able to reduce or to choose when, where, and how to reduce their plastic use. What do you recommend? What is your organization recommending?
So policies that actually phase out over time certain single-use, unnecessary single-use plastic items, like I mentioned, plastic bags, plastic takeout containers, plastic beverage bottles, that kind of thing. These have actually had a great impact in the past. We've seen it in DC, for example, Washington, DC, which is where Oceana is based, where we had a plastic bag ban, and there was a noticeable difference in the amount of plastic bags that were found in the Anacostia River following that, within, you know, the year or two afterward. So we need more of these, but what needs to happen is for us to stop plastic pollution at the source, because historically, the plastics industry has constantly gone after how do we tackle the plastic waste problem. That hasn't worked. Recycling hasn't worked. Only 9% of the plastic waste ever generated has been recycled.
Wow.
That's it. And so this isn't a plastic waste problem. This is a plastic problem. We need to stop producing so much of it in order for it to stop polluting our environment, our air, our soil, our water, our food. I mean, it's infiltrated everything.
It seems to me that was there greater awareness of how little plastic actually recycles, you might see even more public support for tackling the issue of plastic waste. Because, you know, we all, many of us have plastic recycling trash cans that we dutifully put our plastic waste in, and subconsciously, we think we're taking care of the problem, right?
Yes, absolutely. And our polling actually showed that too. Once we showed people that only 9% of the plastic ever generated has been recycled and asked them how concerned they felt, the vast majority felt more concerned about the plastic pollution problem. I think people generally do not realize, the vast majority of people do not realize how little is recycled. And that is entirely on purpose with the plastics industry. They have intentionally spent millions of dollars on PR campaigns to convince us that this is a consumer problem.
What are things that you are suggesting people can do? There has been some success of local city councils, where people have, you know, just ordinary citizens have gone into their city councils and successfully enacted plastic bag bans, perhaps, you know, catching the plastic industry and the industries that rely on it off guard, because it's hyper local and that industry can't be everywhere all at once. Are those the kinds of things that you're still suggesting that people can and should be working on?
Yeah, I think a great example is, so this isn't local level, but it's state level. So California, I know you all have a big California presence. California has a couple of really great things in the pipeline right now. So for one, we have AB 2026. It's a bill that was just introduced on Monday, and it deals with all of that unnecessary and annoying plastic that comes in your online orders. So when you order something online, and I'm sure you've experienced this too, you often will get something very small, but put into a big box with a ton of plastic peanuts or plastic foam or plastic, like they're called air pillows. It's a lot of unnecessary plastic that ends up lasting for centuries, even though it's really serving a one moment of use. And so this AB 2026, this new bill, would actually tackle that and make sure that most of this packaging isn't something that's going to end up in landfills being burned, which pollutes the air, the soil, the water, or ends up in the environment. So it's trying to reduce those things, and we highly support that. We also have the California ballot initiative. So in November, it's really exciting. Californians will actually have the opportunity to vote for this plastics initiative, where single-use plastic, certain single-use plastic will be phased out. The public, as well as local and state lawmakers, have an opportunity to make a change in these kind of places. We also have some federal legislation that would be huge, because the United States is kind of behind the rest of the world in terms of single-use plastic regulation on a national level.
What would the opposition to these policies look like from the plastics industry? What should we look out for and expect? Because maybe if we predict or, you know what to look out for when we see the propaganda against these policies, we'll recognize them for what they are, which is, you know, the industry lobbying against these policies.
Yeah. Unfortunately, the plastics and petrochemical industry has a lot of lobbying power in the United States, which I personally think is one of the reasons that we're a bit behind some of the other countries in terms of federal legislation. The United States, as well as other wealthy countries, including the UK, will ship their plastic waste abroad to developing nations that don't necessarily have the infrastructure or the waste management systems to handle it. And so the stuff that we're putting in our bins, we're thinking is going to be recycled, but will often end up on the other side of the world, polluting, you know, a river in Asia. And so it's, we've heard a lot of arguments on the other side of like, this is an Asia problem, but the real fact of the matter is that we are that problem. We are the ones sending that problem over there. And so that's something to look out for. Just like any other issue, there's a lot of misinformation out there.
You've got a website where people can find out more about the work that you do, Melissa?
Yes, thank you for asking. So Oceana is the largest ocean advocacy organization. We're international, and you can find more about our campaign as well as our other campaigns at usa.oceana.org.
And we'll post a link to that from our website. Thanks so much for joining us, and good luck to you.
Yeah, thank you so much. This was wonderful talking to you.
My guest has been Melissa Valiant, Senior Communications Manager at Oceana. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. You can access this and other interviews on our website, risingupwithsonali.com, by becoming a subscriber. Find our audio podcast on iTunes and Spotify, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali. This is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on community and independent radio stations nationwide. Nearly 2 years after massive nationwide uprisings for racial justice rocked the United States, Black leaders and activists remain frustrated with the slow pace of change. And with good reason. Beyond vague gestures toward diversity, equity, inclusion policies, and calls for racial healing, little appears to have changed. Now, a new book called The Black Agenda: Bold Solutions for a Broken System brings together a collection of demands to center Black leadership and Black-led solutions across the spectrum of social problems in the nation. My guest is Anna Gifty Opoku-Agyeman. She is a doctoral student studying public policy and economics at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. Her work has been featured in Teen Vogue, The New York Times, Slate Magazine, NPR, Fortune, Marketplace, and The Guardian. And she's the co-founder of the Sadie Collective, the only nonprofit organization addressing the lack of Black women in economics and related fields. In 2020, she became the youngest recipient for the CEDAW Women's Rights Award by the UN Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. She is the editor of The Black Agenda: Bold Solutions for a Broken System. Welcome to the program, Anna.
Thank you so much for having me.
So first, let's talk about where we are today. As I mentioned, nearly 2 years since the 2020 racial justice uprisings that were really historic, right? And they were historic because they were so multi-generational, multi-racial. And of course, it was the last year of the Trump presidency. And it was a moment of hope for many of us in the United States who cared about racial justice. How do you assess where we are at this point on in early 2022?
So that's a great question. Essentially what's going on is we've essentially reverted back to even worse attitudes towards Black Lives Matter since those uprisings in the summer of 2020. So I cite Professor Hakeem Jefferson's work where he talks a little bit about how the support for Black Lives Matter actually declined past its pre-2020 levels in 2021. And so essentially where we're at right now is that, you know, despite the fact that, you know, Black folks are still, you know, struggling in a number of different areas of society, we are still not seeing bold policies that are targeted at the Black American community more specifically, but broadly, really in addressing sort of marginalized communities, we're not seeing any progress on that front as well. Though there are sort of calls for more bold policies to address those schisms within how we think about policy making, and then how do we think about the needs of the people.
I mean, that's remarkable. So there was a certain level of support for Black Lives Matter and for, you know, seeing that there needs to be an addressing of things like police brutality. Then during the protest, you saw that support skyrocket, really big support across all racial groups. You're saying now that it's gone down below those levels that was before the protests. Why? Is it the conservative pushback against critical race theory, the sort of Trump effect of using race as a wedge issue for Republicans to win elections, and basically just the resurgence of overt white supremacy?
I think it's all those things and more, right? But I think it's also the clear decentering of Black voices, especially Black expertise, which is what this book highlights. So if we're thinking about the criminal justice system and we're thinking about what's happening with police, it's important that we actually have Black experts who know the literature, who know what's going on, both on the ground and with respect to the empirical work that's been done. And so what we're seeing is that while all of those, you know, common themes are coming across the news and mainstream media, we're also seeing this sort of silencing of Black experts who ought to be at the helm of the conversation, right? Individuals who understand, you know, the disproportionate effects of policing on communities, not just on Black men, but also on Black women and children, in addition to other communities that are affected, such as Latinos and those who are Native American or Indigenous. And so we're thinking about the fact that not only is expertise missing from the conversation, but we're also missing these sort of critical components of how do we think about bold policies in light of the expertise, right? It can't be that we are talking about a problem that has persisted since the inception of America the same way each decade. We need new and bold solutions, especially led by those who are disproportionately affected.
And do you see this attitude in the discussions around President Biden's clear announcement that he wants to pick a Black woman to replace Justin Stephen Breyer at the Supreme Court? You see all of these voices saying, oh, this is just going to be an affirmative action hire, almost just assuming that there couldn't possibly be a Black woman qualified enough to sit on the Supreme Court.
Yeah, I think it's always interesting that people bring up qualifications when it comes to Black people. It's something that the late W.E.B. Du Bois talks about, you know, this idea that Black experts can never, ever be seen as objective or relevant enough for the mainstream, despite the fact that our lives are engrossed in public life, in public commentary, and how we think about social justice broadly. And so it's funny to me that, you know, people say that, you know, Black women can't be qualified for the Supreme Court, when in fact, a lot of times Black folks have to work twice or thrice as hard to get just on the same level playing field, to just be recognized as leaders and experts within their respective disciplines. The other thing that is quite interesting is the fact that Black women actually do make up a substantial part of the United States. And so this idea that Black women have never been represented in the highest court of the land is a little problematic, right? Considering the fact that, you know, we just went through an entire election period in which Black women were critical to the Democrats cinching that election for President Biden. And so I do see it as appropriate that President Biden would then appoint a Black woman in the Supreme Court. And I would also want to make note that, you know, President Biden is actually being quite consistent in how he's appointing Black women into leadership posts, right? Currently, there's a conversation happening around Dr. Lisa D. Cook, who is currently going to be potentially the first Black woman to ever be on the Federal Reserve Board of Governors, which is essentially the body that governs and sees over our economy, right? We also saw this with the Department of Labor with his appointment of Janelle Jones, who's no longer there, but she was the first Black woman to be the chief economist of the Department of Labor. We saw this with his appointment of Cecilia Rouse, Dr. Cecilia Rouse, who was actually the first chair of the Council of Economic Advisors. So it's actually not lost on me that Biden does recognize the role that Black women are playing, right? He's literally taking the listen to Black women phrase and actually putting it into practice. And I think we ought to do that as well.
Let's talk about specifically the topics you tackle in the book, The Black Agenda, which you have edited. You start out with climate change and climate justice movements. This is a realm, the environmental movements realm that a couple of decades ago were quite dominated by white leaders who basically placed themselves up front. But you saw the sort of environmental justice movements, native-led movements, and very specifically Black-led movements rising to the forefront. Why is climate an important issue where Black leadership matters?
Absolutely. So one thing I want to mention is that I'm actually not an author of any of the essays in the book. These essays are written by the Black experts that were invited. And so that being said, with the Black climate section, right, we're talking about Black leaders who have been at the forefront of either the science, advocacy, or both. And so what they're really talking about is the fact that the climate change movement is indeed whitewashed, right? And it's whitewashed in a way that actually harms Black and Brown communities. And so it's in everybody's best interest that Black and Brown leaders be at the helm of the conversation when it comes to thinking about climate solutions that serve us all. And so one thing that Dr. Marshall Shepard, who opens up the chapter, talks about is the fact that Hurricane Katrina kind of gave us a little bit of a glimpse of the devastation that climate change can cause if gone unchecked. And so when we think about that as sort of our starting point, it matters then that those communities that are going to be disproportionately affected by the climate crisis then be the ones to think about solutions that actually encompass us all. It's the idea of going for those who are worse off so that everybody is subsequently better off. And to your point about, you know, the climate space being largely white dominated, if you think about the leadership and think about folks who oftentimes get airtime, that's sort of why the essay Stop All Lives Mattering, The Climate Crisis by Mary Anise Hagler is so key, right? This idea that, you know, when we think about the climate crisis, climate is at the end of the day, not the great equalizer, as she says, but rather the great multiplier. And so if you think about the inequities that currently exist as a result of different intersecting systemic failures, think about climate as sort of, I would say, multiplying that, right? Multiplying those things by 2-3 times as worse in the outcomes that affect Black and Brown people.
And of course, so many times, if you have solutions being put forward by those who are privileged, they end up being solutions whose downsides impact vulnerable communities. So we see things like the tech solutions being put forward, in spaces like the COP26, the so-called net zero emissions carbon capture technologies. We saw a lot of Black and Brown activists on the ground in Glasgow last year saying, those technologies are likely going to be placed in our communities and we are going to be bearing the brunt of them. That's a critical issue, right?
Absolutely, right? This idea that when, you know, folks are thinking about surveillance or thinking about ways to work out the kinks in new technologies is almost always tested in Black and Brown communities that are going to be most vulnerable to them is a problem, right? And it's also addressed in the technology chapter. This is something that Dr. Brandeis Marshall calls algorithmic assault. Deb Raji adds on and says, look, what's happening with the tech giants having sort of this control over the narrative around tech is also problematic. And so we have to get precise with the language, as Jordan Harrod mentioned in her essay. And this idea is, at the end of the day, technology and climate, alongside healthcare, education, the economy, and the other topics that are addressed throughout the book are all tied inextricably together. And so it's not enough to say, oh, we only want Black folks to speak on these certain issues, because at the end of the day, these issues are intertwined in a way that actually harm Black folks disproportionately.
Right. And so that idea, especially, and I'm glad you brought up healthcare, that idea that was raised during the pandemic, we are all in this together. A lot of Black leaders pointed out saying, well, actually, some of us are impacted much more than others.
Right.
And when it comes to healthcare in particular, a lot of the sort of pre-existing conditions facing Black communities because of the inequity in our healthcare system made them more vulnerable. Right. So what is the Black agenda on healthcare?
There's a lot on the Black agenda on healthcare. And one thing I want to note about the healthcare chapter is that oftentimes when you are watching the news, you only hear from doctors. And one thing that I will make note of is, you know, as a child of nurses, nurses are oftentimes the backbone of the healthcare system. And so I went out of my way to reach out to nurses, nursing researchers, epidemiologists, folks who are thinking about public health on a praxis basis, folks who are thinking about the framework of how health is administered, to really kind of illustrate what's going on with healthcare as we see it in respect to COVID-19 and the pandemic.
And so, nurses tend to be women of color, right? They're disproportionately.
Exactly, exactly, disproportionately so. And so that being said, the Black agenda with respect to healthcare is multi-pronged, right? Folks are talking about how healthcare cannot exist in a vacuum. We can't talk about solving the problem with respect to the pandemic without addressing economic justice, without addressing housing justice, without addressing how technology actually creates very uniquely horrible situations for Black women in particular, and how colorism sort of comes into play as well, right? There are a number of different intersecting problems that create uniquely bad situations for Black people across the country and arguably across the world. And so what the healthcare agenda talks about within the Black Agenda book is that, look, we need multi-pronged solutions that don't just address what's going on in our actual bodies, but what's also going on within the healthcare system itself. So Dr. Monica McLemore talks about we need a much better way of diversifying the workforce with respect to the healthcare system, right? We need to think about how the hierarchy that exists within healthcare is actually undermining care as we speak. You know, Dr. Dara Mendez and Jewel Scott talk about the fact that, you know, if we want to actually have a healthcare system that has equity at the center of it, we need to really talk about how critical race theory plays a role in shaping the praxis of health, right? How do we think about administering health if we don't think about how racism has actually led us to administer health poorly? And so we're touching on a number of different facets here, but at the end of the day, it's really about, you know, how do we ensure that Black people have better health outcomes and therefore resulting in better health outcomes for everyone else?
I was also particularly interested in the fact that one of your writers brought up Henrietta Lacks, the Black woman whose cells,
right,
and whose cell line that remains alive today, and, you know, about whom books and movies have been made, really is, you know, is someone whose literal sort of biological legacy,
yes,
forms the basis of so much of our healthcare technology today, right?
Right.
It's amazing.
Yeah, and I think that's a very clear example of Black life not being valued, right? This idea that her cells were harvested when she was essentially deceased and then used to then be profitable for so many predominantly white institutions within the healthcare space is problematic, because then these same healthcare institutions don't hire Black people, they don't value Black people, they don't even acknowledge the contributions of Black folks. And so while people might say, you know, I admire the resilience of Henrietta Lacks and her legacy in science, we still don't know if, you know, her family has been compensated as much as they should have, if the communities that are benefiting from her cells are actually communities of color, right? These are sort of lingering questions that have made her situation a very unique one, and one that actually aligns quite nicely with what the healthcare agenda within the Black Agenda book suggests.
There's much to discuss here. Of course, we don't have time to talk about it all. I want to bring up the economy. This is, I know, something that's near and dear to your heart. Tell me a little bit about how we need to, what you think needs to happen in order to center Black-led solutions on the economy, because this is critical when we talk about,
yes,
equity or equality. You know,
yes,
we've got to get down to brass tacks. We've got to get down to money.
100%. I think the biggest thing is actually illustrated by Janelle Jones and Angela Hanks's essay titled Black Women Best, right? This idea of America's best begins with Black Women Best. And so Black Women Best is a framework that was coined by Janelle Jones that says, look, the best outcome for Black women economically is a better outcome for everyone else. So if you think about that across, you know, economic opportunity, you think about that across education, if you think about that across voting rights, right? If you are centering Black women in how we think about the economy and policy in general, ultimately, Black women are a really, really good proxy for progress in this country. Oftentimes what's happening with Black women is happening worse for other marginalized groups, if not at the same level. So think about Native Americans, think about Latina women. These groups are comparable in the sense that their economic outcomes are very much alike, However, Black women oftentimes are uniquely marginalized in the workplace. And so it's important to recognize that if we're framing economic policies around workers, around thinking about, you know, how does recovery look like? How do we measure certain economic data or economic statistics? Starting with Black women and disaggregating the data is a really, really important place to start. And so if we think about the economic solutions towards relief and recovery, as I mentioned, we want to think about, are Black women, you know, being relieved of the economic crisis? Are Black women recovering? I'll give you an example of what I'm talking about. Right after the 2008 crisis, we saw there was a long recovery period from 2009 to 2011 and beyond. And during that period, while every other group's unemployment rate declined, Black women's unemployment rate rose. And that's actually a similar trend as we're seeing as of, I would say, January of 2022, right, where everybody's unemployment rate basically declined, Black women's unemployment rate rose. And what we're also seeing too is that Black women are the backbone of their communities. And this is reflected even further in the criminal justice chapter under Dr. Hedwig Lee's essay, where she talks about how the mass incarceration of Black men has left a lot of Black women to essentially be the backbone of their households. And so it's absolutely essential that Black women then be used as a proxy of progress, specifically economic progress, when we think about the economy moving forward.
You have a chapter, an essay written by Fanaba Ado that links the issue of the economy with education. Black generation wealth depends on student debt forgiveness. And tell me a little bit about how those two issues intersect and how the educational system in particular can learn so much from the leadership shown in historically Black colleges and universities, HBCUs.
Absolutely. So HBCUs, for those who don't know, are historically Black colleges and universities, as you mentioned. And so they actually educate the largest percentage of Black students in the United States. And HBCUs are actually a common theme that pop up throughout the entire book, where many of the experts say, look, if we're thinking about caregiving, if we're thinking about the future of work, we need to begin with HBCUs that have actually been instrumental in educating the next generation of Black leaders and Black professionals. And so in her essay, Dr. Fanaba Ado illustrates what's going on with the student debt crisis. She says, look, what we're seeing is that Black folks are disproportionately borrowing money and taking out loans in a way that does not allow them to build lasting wealth, generational
and this
wealth.
Isn't surprising considering that there hasn't been generational wealth to
That's
fund
exactly
a college
right.
to begin with.
That's exactly right. And if you also think about Black Americans in particular, right, going to Cliff Albright's essay, Black Americans didn't have voting rights for a very, very long time, right? And if you think about slavery, the legacy of slavery, Jim Crow, segregation, and everything that's come afterwards, there have been a number of different institutional-wide situations in which Black Americans have been intentionally kept away from wealth building and building equity. And so what Dr. Fanaba Ado is talking about here is that we see amongst student debt holders that Black women have the highest amount of student debt. And so going back to what I was saying about Black Women Invest, it's important that we then target student debt forgiveness around forgiving debt of those who are most vulnerable to the economic system as it currently stands. And so she says, look at Black students, look at Black people. These are the individuals who oftentimes are most vulnerable to predatory loans within the higher education system, but also to for-profit colleges that tend to make students take out loans. And so it's in everybody's best interest, economically speaking, to have folks be forgiven of their student loans, especially Black folks who we hope can build generational wealth from here on out.
And then how can HBCUs kind of show the way to other and to all colleges and universities, higher institutions of higher learning that are struggling today? You know, we have multiple crises around either student debt or what is being taught or even the economic setup where students are being asked to pay more and more. Faculty are not necessarily even getting paid fairly. You see institutions being run like corporations. And of course, all of this in an economy that fails to be a meritocracy as much as it, you know, we might like to think it is.
I always say that academia is not a meritocracy, it's a mirrortocracy, meaning that academia oftentimes like many other institutions across the West, replicates itself. And so a number of individuals who might sit in academia may say, look, we are interested in admitting Black and Brown students who can clear a certain threshold. But we know that, you know, based on the data, based on the evidence, that threshold moves depending on your racial and ethnic identity. And currently there's a lot of conversation happening around that in higher education as we speak. And so to your point about academic institutions playing a role in doing this, first and foremost, I would recommend looking at the Black agenda and seeing how it might fit into your syllabus, right? This is a book that is a resource first and foremost. You might not agree with every perspective in the book, but this book does add invaluable resource and invaluable insights that can then sort of usher conversations that can lead to more equitable spaces within your academic or, you know, collegiate institution, right? And so that being said, it's not enough to say, look, I care about Black people and I'm not racist. You actually have to center Black voices and Black expertise. As Dr. Tressie McMillan Cotton says in her foreword of the book, she says, look, any place that's not centering Black expertise is becoming a vacuum for white rage. Mm-hmm. And so if we are to ensure that equity is at the center of the future that we're hoping to all arrive at, it's not enough then to say, look, I'm just going to talk about Black people during Black History Month, and then I'm done for the year. That's not enough. We actually have to have Black voices be integrated into the literal cultural, and I would say into the literal air that we breathe in the academic space. And so it's not enough to say, look, we want to silo Black people to just one thing, but rather see how Black people can integrate into the vast amount of knowledge that is